Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I am Pranay and with me there's Anupam, and today we are going to discuss about making fiscal space for the expenditures that government will need to do in response to COVID-19. So first of all, Anupam, I had never imagined that there will come a day when I'll be talking to you and both of us will be discussing about how to make government spend more.
Yeah, that's the irony of the situation. If there's one thing that COVID has successfully managed to do is, convert most of the fiscal hawks around the world into Keynesian economists who would argue for higher fiscal spending. And I think that is quite extraordinary in its own case. I remember when I was writing one of, column as to what to do, I remember one sentence from it where I said, this is not the time for fiscal prudence. And when I was writing it, I was quite amazed that, these words would come out from me. But I suppose it...
Yeah. Anupam said that. Okay. So I'll hold this against you. Okay. Yeah. So let's get started. So the main argument that is being made is that given the situation that we are in, the economy is not doing well, the government tax collections will also be low because there's no economic activity, and a whole lot of things that will need to be done on the health side and also on supporting the economy, incomes of people who are lost out because of this lockdown, a whole lot of extra spending will have to be done by the government. And the question that often people will ask is, where is the money if we want to do all this spending? So that's what this episode is about. And let's start to try to understand, Anupam, first, that what is the size of the extra support required from the government side? Okay. And again, there are no hard numbers that we have, but there is an article that Devesh Kapoor and Arvind Subramaniam have written in Business Standard, and they try to come up with a very conservative estimate for estimating the amount of additional spending that government needs to do. Okay, so the number that they come up with is a total of 10 lakh crores or 10 trillion rupees. So 1 trillion rupees is 1 lakh crores, so that it's clear going ahead. So this is the total demand. Okay, now the demand is composed of really two things. One is healthcare related expenditures itself, which is taken to be around 2% of the GDP, additional apart from what is already done. Remember, the current healthcare expenditure of from the government side is 1.4% of the GDP thereabouts. So this is talking about doubling that and more than doubling this. Right? So this is about healthcare expenditures. The second one is about household income support. Basically, they are assuming that a third of the incomes that will be lost due to all this lockdown will be compensated by the government in one way or the other, through cash transfers or through providing more employment later in NREGS or whatever. Right. So this total comes out to be around 5.5 lakh crores. So the total demand is around 10 lakh crores. This is what the government needs to spend additionally. Anupam, does this sound about right?
Yeah, these are such astronomical figures that, it all about sounds right. Our own estimate, I think, was that we need to be spending about 10 to 12% of GDP. How much is that in terms of lakh crores? I'm not...
That will be even high. So, yeah, India's GDP is 200 lakh crores. So, if you're saying that we have to spend 10%, will come around 20
lakh crores. So that's probably our estimate. Again, there's no very clear way to kind of pinpoint as to the exact number, because it really depends on what the demands are. While I think Devesh Kapoor and Arvind Subramaniam have kept the demands also slightly more conservative, if any of our listeners remember, Nitin and I had done this episode on what is required going forward in terms of an economic plan, and we had kind of divided it into three parts in terms of, you know, immediate relief, some form of rebound through an economic stimulus, and a long-term reconstruction. So sometimes I think this long-term economic reconstruction is not given as much importance as the first two, which is immediate relief and economic stimulus. So if you take just about those two, I think 10 trillion sounds good. But if you want to get into that reconstruction phase, which means, you know, really big investment in infrastructure, for example, or solving the entire banking crisis, etc., you will require another 10 lakh crores. And so that takes our total to about 20 lakh crores.
Right. Just 20 lakh crores.
Just about. You know, it's not really too much.
Yeah. Currently, yeah, this demand, as you said, is very conservative, assuming that the money is required only for two things: supporting household incomes and doing the extra spend on healthcare.
Yeah.
Right. And as you said, there are a lot of other things that will need to be done over a longer term. Again, get the infrastructure back, improve banking, etc., which will require a whole lot more. But let's reduce our problem currently to this 10 lakh crores, which itself is a big astronomical number which is required, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So now let's talk about what are the options in order to finance this kind of money which is required. Now, again, just to put in the context, so this 10 lakh crores that are required is around 5% of the GDP, and the total spending of all governments combined in India is around 26% of GDP. So what we are talking about is increasing government spending from 26% to 31%.
Yeah, right. That increased spending, just again, remember that increased spending by government always has massive implications. I mean, we don't want to get into that right now, perhaps, but remember that there is a social cost of public funds that's, you know, 1:3. So I think that is also important to recognize that while everyone would, you know, go out and say that it requires a massive amount of fiscal expenditure from the government to get out of this mess, that also has its own set of costs, which means that we have to be very careful in what we decide to spend on. Stimulus just doesn't mean that the government goes on a spending spree on their pet subjects, which was before the crisis. Yeah. But instead, you have to be very, very careful that the returns on whatever investment is being done should be at least comparable, if not higher, to what is going in. So that's essentially the basic ask of all of this. So in terms of relief, you can't really look at you can't look at that form of return. That will more or less be 1:1. So if you spend 1 rupee, the net gain to society will be 1 rupee. But you know, in things like capital expenditure, which we have recommended, so probably 1 rupee that is spent by the government can result in something like 4 rupees return on GDP. So, you know, increase in GDP. So that's the kind of things we are looking at. Just to, again, put all of this in, you know, bracket it in economic terms.
Yeah. So we are looking at really what, assuming that whatever money is raised, this is spent on these two very narrow goals, which are of utmost importance for now. Right.
Yeah.
So now let's come to how do we supply this kind of additional demand, right? So what are the options with the government in order to finance this extra 10 lakh crores? Now, again, from the article that Devesh Kapoor and Arvind Subramaniam write, they propose around 5 options. Okay. And Anupam, I want your take on each of these options, and also what are some of the additional options that you want to talk about. Okay.
Yeah.
So first one is really, let's talk about the big one, right? So the big one that they recommend is about these government securities, so which are also called GSEC. So these, they talk about that they can finance around 5 lakh crores. Okay. So can you explain, Anupam, what are these GSECs and how do you get 5 lakh crores out of them?
I think aspiring to get 5 lakh crores out of G6 is probably a stretch, and I'll explain why that is, unless you coordinate it with a monetary policy, which we'll speak about later. But G6 are nothing but bonds or government. There are instruments of debts that instruments of debt that the government uses in order to mobilize resources. So essentially, if the government of India wants to borrow, they will essentially issue a bond or a bill. Bond is a longer term and a bill is a shorter term duration to the market. And then anyone who wants to basically lend to the government, they buy these bonds and lend to the government. And that has a particular coupon rate or the rate of interest that they'll get back. And basically, everyone's happy. I mean, government gets its money, people get a very safe investment, and they get an interest paid on it, and so on.
Yeah. So, in essence, it is backed by the government, the sovereign government of India, and there is a fixed rate of return, probably. So, it's just like, you know, you would have at an individual level, we buy a national savings certificate or something like that, right?
Essentially, yeah. A national savings certificate is a very narrow instrument of public debt, but government bond is a more, I mean, I think it's just meant for much broader this thing. So if you look at the one big problem of this is that the bond market in India is not as developed as one would have hoped for, which means, you know, ordinary citizens such as you and I will find it very difficult to trade these securities in the secondary market for the bonds, right? And that is one of the big problems in order to, you know, tap into the savings of the people. But what would essentially then happen is that the bonds that are issued by the government will have to be absorbed by banks and LIC and so on. You know, these kind of and mutual funds and et cetera. And that can result in its own set of problems where banks are already overburdened with government securities, by the way, and they do not have a lot of lending space. And therefore, I don't know how successful that's going to be. The only way that it can be successful is if the RBI gives the backing, saying to the banks that, you know, if they buy enough government securities, then the RBI will buy it off them. So that's essentially RBI lending to the government.
Okay. Yeah. So just to clarify this, private sector or household savings are already quite low in India. So, and you said it's anyways very difficult for an individual to participate in the bond market. So if you combine both those effects, it means that it's going to be really difficult for these extra securities to be absorbed by the household sector.
Yeah.
Then the second option, which you mentioned about the banks, now banks are itself in quite a troubled state. So expecting banks to absorb this will, in fact, it might even crowd out whatever little lending space they have for private capital investment, right?
Exactly. That's the precise problem. So household savings rate is what now? 7.2% of our GDP. It's in fact come down. It was about 9.5 a few years back, and it's now come down to about 7 or 7.2%. And there's a lot of, you know, claims on that small savings that exist. You know, corporates want to borrow from it. Individuals themselves want to use those savings. And now, you know, state government plus union government plus PSUs all want to borrow from the same pot, and that pot is essentially empty, and it doesn't have that much space for this, you know, massive kind of requirement that the union government has now.
Right. So now you're saying that RBI might be able to buy these government securities. Now, surely there are going to be fallouts of that as well.
Yes.
So what could be that?
So what has happened, interestingly, and this kind of ties in with one of their other proposals, and I'm combining the two here. What happened, I mean, just a very brief historical perspective on this. Until 1994, RBI used to buy government bonds directly from the, you know, from the union government. So the government of the day would issue a bond. These were called ad hoc treasury bills. And RBI would essentially lap them up. And in what that amounted to was that the RBI was printing money and giving it to the government. And we know what the government spent it on. That resulted in high fiscal deficits. It resulted in crowding out of private investment. And of course, it resulted in inflation. So all things that are considered, you know, unholy in the macroeconomic world. And therefore, I think about 1994, they decided that this can no longer go on, and they abolished this ad hoc treasury bills, which meant that RBI was disallowed from buying directly from the government. But in times of crisis such as this, go back to 2008 financial crisis, and even in, you know, our own kind of fall from growth in the last year or so, RBI has been kind of propping up government finances, but it does that indirectly. So essentially, the government would still issue bonds, banks would buy it, and then RBI would buy it off the bank's balance sheet. So RBI does something called open market operations. Essentially, it would go onto the market and say, secondary market, and say that it will buy whatever bond it has in order to increase liquidity. And RBI has essentially been doing a lot of this in the last 1 year, which means that it is expected to continue doing this now. So that's essentially what it will have to do in terms of, you know, if the government issues G-Secs, that's the only way possible. As I said, households do not really have the capacity to absorb the G-Secs. Banks don't have the capacity. Corporates don't have the capacity. And right now, foreign institutional investment is going out of India. So which means that, again, they might not necessarily lap this up right now. Which means that the only player in the market which is big enough to kind of absorb this is the RBI.
So you're saying that this is one way to monetize the deficit through some other means?
Through other means, which is why I think the second, I mean, now what most people are saying is that we know this is what will happen. That is, the banks will buy it, and, you know, again, the government will essentially arm twist SBI to buy a lot of this, and then RBI will give assurance to SBI that we'll buy it off you. And then, so a lot of people are saying, why this indirect method? Why not, you know, we break the rules temporarily and RBI directly buys from the government? I am extremely wary of that. So, for example, again, in that particular article, these guys suggest that about 1 to 1.5 trillion rupees or 1.5 lakh crores can actually be gained through this method, whereas of basically printing money. But again, it's A, you have to either, you know, change the laws, or you have to create a special kind of one-off ordinance that RBI can do this. And that creates, I mean, it's a problematic thing, but it probably has to be done at some level, either directly or indirectly. I mean, they can choose. I would still prefer it that it's done indirectly and not directly. Monetizing of deficit, just so as to not create a precedence, right? Next time, let's say, you know, when everything is normal and GDP growth falls from 6% to 4.5%, then I don't want whatever government is in power at that point of time to, you know, use this as a precedence such that RBI again starts buying government bonds directly. So just in order to avoid that and no other reason, I think it's better to go through this indirect channel where government issues G-Secs. But the if they hope that, you know, about 6 to 6.5 trillion rupees is going to be raised this way, I think that is being slightly optimistic. I don't think there's enough, I mean, that much can be done by RBI just by monetizing the deficit.
But so there are basically two options that you talked about, right? One is the open market operations at a much larger scale than what is currently happening, which is the indirect method in another way. Spelled differently. And the other method, which you said, is to change the laws and bring back that regime of automatic monetization of deficit for a small period of time, and the RBI directly buys it.
Yeah.
Now, why do we even need the second method? Are there any advantages of RBI directly buying from the government, or open market operations can do this just as well as the other one?
Nothing really. It's about reducing transaction cost, speeding up the process, and cutting down the middleman. That's about it.
Right. Will the second method lead to a lesser risk for the other banks?
Not really. See, all banks as it is are oversubscribed to government bonds at the moment. So, you know, I mean, if the SLR requirement, the statutory liquidity ratio, the amount of government bonds that they're forced to keep, is about 20%, in fact, of their deposits that they have. Most banks actually have a lot more than that because they're completely unwilling to lend. They're as it is holding, you know, government bonds. So in that sense, it really doesn't matter if they have a little bit more than that.
Okay. So this totally, it comes to around 6.5 lakh crores, and which you think is being very optimistic.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's go to the second big part, which is an interesting one, is about foreign borrowing, right? And they estimate that you can gain around 1.5 lakh crores through the foreign borrowing path. And they are being very conservative here because they say that there is very little from that we can expect from other countries' investment coming in, given how the situation is the world over? Which means from the foreign borrowing side, there are only a few options left according to them. One is non-resident bank deposits, which we had done earlier also. So non-resident Indians, we encourage them to invest back in India. And then the other option is multilateral organizations. We take loans from them and repurpose existing loans. So if we accumulate these three methods, we can get around 1.5 lakh crores. Now, you say that this is not the right number. Maybe there are other options in foreign borrowing. Why do you say that?
Yeah, so NRIs have always been, I mean, this kind of go-to or the last resort kind of thing for an Indian government whenever we've had a financial crisis or an economic crisis, and NRIs have bailed us out to so whatever extent they can, in terms of, you know, you have a special kind of account for NRIs, promise them slightly higher returns, and generally they've lapped it up because it's a good investment option, and so that has worked, so that can continue to work. There's no two words about it, so that's fine. Official sources, these multilateral, so no other country at the moment will be willing to lend because, you know, they will require all of their financial resources within their own country. So, you know, just bilateral kind of funding is completely out of the window, which mm-hmm. leads us to, you know, this kind of multilateral organizations and multilateral institutions and borrowing from them, which means it's IMF and World Bank essentially. So I think World Bank has already said that they'll give us $1 billion, which is just a, you know, a drop in the ocean of what we require, mm-hmm. right? It's a start, but it's extremely low. Mm-hmm. And remember that there will always be, you know, competing demands on these institutions. So it's not just India. Mm-hmm. Every other country pretty much, which has been ravaged and hit by the coronavirus. And we don't know how much this is going to play out. I mean, we don't know if there's going to be, and you know, not that I wish it or this thing, but we don't know if there's going to be a surge in Africa, for example. And if that is the case, there are a lot many more countries which would require those funds far more urgently than India. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, realism in from the Indian perspective. Yes, we should try and get it. But I'm saying from IMF's perspective, they will probably give it to the more needy country, whatever that perspective should be. So in that sense, you know, there's always going to be competition. We might really not get as much, but we should try and get whatever we can. No words about it. But the big point of difference, I think, between what I'm thinking and what those guys are thinking, and I don't want to be arrogant here, but I think they're being slightly pessimistic about the availability of funding sources from other investors, right? My view is this. At a time of crisis that is now, I think we should, you know, use every other source of funding in order to give the relief. But in the slightly medium term, and this means probably even 6 to 9 months from now, when the pandemic has slightly retreated and things are becoming beginning to go back to normal, you would see one difference. So as of now, investors have all fled from emerging markets and gone to the safe haven, which is US Treasury bills. And therefore, you're seeing this kind of retreat of foreign money from everywhere else. And that is understandable. But 6 to 9 months down the line, suddenly, you know, they'll get antsy because the interest rates in the US will again start becoming zero bound. Because US is going to go through a recession by itself. So which means Federal Reserve is going to keep interest rates at zero, which means they're not going to earn anything on the investments they've made. And therefore, I think given that the investor profile around the world, you know, it'll be a very diverse set of risk profiles. There will always be a whole set of investors who will want, you know, their portfolio to have slightly more higher returns bonds and in their portfolio. Mm-hmm. So in that kind of sense, if India offers a sovereign-backed bond, which is, again, very specific kind of bond, let's say an infrastructure bond, which we require, mm-hmm. by the way, I think there will be, which is can be linked to kind of equity and so on, there will be a lot of takers for that. Because remember, let's say we offer, an Indian bond typically, for something like this can attract something probably like a 7% interest rate in the world for a long-term kind of sovereign bond. And that should be compared to most other bonds from, developed countries where it's probably giving you a negative kind of return. So I'm sure that there will be a lot of investors who want that 7% return. And therefore, I think you can, you know, raise quite a lot. So I was talking to our colleague and co-founder, Narayan, and I think according to us, you can raise something like 3.5 to 4.5 lakh crores this way.
50 to $75 billion through this mechanism. So, and that's not a small amount. That's about, you know, three times what these guys are saying through NRIs and multilateral institutions. I think that's the scope that we should deliver. So you can, you know, essentially what I'm saying is you can create a sovereign backed special purpose vehicle for essentially large infrastructure projects. And remember, there's a whole set of institutions, whole set of investors, right? From everyday kind of investors to large firms which are investing, mutual funds, pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, etc., which will always look for things which are slightly, you know, even if they allocate something like 20% of their portfolio to slightly higher risk but higher return, I think that that by itself is a captive audience that we can have. That can be, you know, then I think complemented by these NRI funds, you can also have, you know, bilateral funding by a country like Japan, which has, you know, excess capital but doesn't know where to spend and is, you know, always facing recession and, you know, downturn in the economy. They'd be willing to fund these things as well. So I don't think the international market is as dead as they make it out to be.
If you look at it from a temporal perspective, what you are saying is this will be possible a few months down the line when the pandemic is in a more manageable state, right?
Yeah. So my view on this is very clear, that we have enough resources at the moment through the other mechanisms that I said to cater to the relief aspect of it, and even to some extent to the economic stimulus aspect of it. So in terms of giving tax breaks or tax waivers and giving cheap loans, all for all of that, I think we have enough capital and enough money and resources. But for the long term, that infrastructure development that I was talking about is where this mechanism should kick in.
All right. Okay. So this was the second method, or the third one. We talked about government securities, monetization of deficit and foreign borrowing. Now let's come to the fourth one, which is a slightly more controversial one. But hey, we are talking about all controversial things only today. So let's talk about this, about RBI reserves being transferred to the government. Last year, I guess it was when there was a committee formed by the former RBI governor, Bimal Jalan, heading it, and they decided what should be the volume of transfer between the RBI and the government, and they did a transfer of around 1.76 lakh crores. So now, is there an option of doing a further transfer from the RBI to the government?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So, so let's just talk about what these reserves are very briefly. I don't want to bore any of our listeners, but the idea is that RBI is ultimately also an organization which makes profits, and it does this through various means. Essentially when it buys government bonds, that has an interest and it earns that interest. When it lends to the banks, commercial banks, it earns an interest on that. When it even prints notes, by the way, it makes money on that. It spends money on that and then makes money when it gives it out in exchange for the bond. So there's various ways in which the central bank also makes money and basically makes a profit. And in fact, RBI makes a lot of profit. It would probably surprise a few of our listeners, but RBI makes a lot of profits, right? Now, what does it do with those profits is important. Part of it transfers back to the government. And this is routine. It does it every year. That's not a very big amount. But a large part of that profit, it actually, you know, sends it to a special account, which is basically called provisions, okay? And other liabilities and provisions. Basically, this is a rainy account for a rainy day, right? And so it has a whole set of contingency plans, and it essentially saves up for those contingencies. So essentially, these would be, for example, since the RBI owns a lot of, let's say, dollar-denominated bonds, if the dollar, you know, depreciates and the rupee appreciates against the dollar, then RBI will lose money and quite a lot of it. So in order to kind of avoid that scenario, it basically saves up money. There could be a case where, let's say, it has bought a lot of euro bonds and the euro bonds fall in the amount of return that it gives, then again RBI will lose money. So to save against that, it holds some money. The other one is it holds Indian bonds again, and Indian bonds could again lose money, and therefore it saves again. That finally, it's about gold, right? The RBI owns a lot of gold, and if gold prices suddenly falls in the market, then RBI will face a loss, and again, to protect against that kind of loss, to hedge against that kind of loss, it saves up some money. So these are various ways in which various reasons for which it saves money. The important thing, I think, to take away from this is that essentially the view now is that it's probably saving too much for this rainy day fund. So in normal circumstances, I would say I'd rather the RBI save for such contingencies rather, you know, instead of the government getting its hand on it, on this money and then spending it unwisely. But given the special circumstances that we are in, I think some bits of it can be transferred to the money. Now, how, you know, the just to quote, you know, our good friend Deepak Shenoy in all of this, he's written that this amount of reserves that the RBI has is like, you know, starting an umbrella factory to save against a rainy day instead of just holding one umbrella for a rainy day, right? That's the level that we're talking about. So just to give you an idea of numbers and how much we can make from this, RBI's total balance sheet is 47 lakh crores, okay? And the provisions that it has for this rainy day fund that it has is about 13 lakh crores, which is roughly about 27% of the balance sheet. Now, the Bimal Jalan committee, which is an extremely conservative committee, remember these are, you know, made of former, I mean, headed by a former RBI governor, which means that they will be conservative, says that a good rainy day fund is about 21% of the balance sheet, right? So the difference, that is the 6% of the balance sheet, roughly comes up to about 4 lakh crores. So that's the amount of money that we can actually use.
Okay, so that's a big number.
4 lakh crores can be transferred from RBI's reserves to the government. But it, again, this has to come with a whole set of, you know, very clear understanding that this will not happen over and again, because this is a buildup of the reserves. It didn't happen just last year. This is a buildup of the reserves over many, many, many years. And therefore, the government should not get used to this kind of transfers. It can happen once. Next time it can happen is probably another 20 years or so.
So basically, we are saying that even by following the Bimal Jalan committee recommendations, there is an option to transfer more reserves from RBI to the government.
Exactly. So I'm not saying that we should eat up into RBI's reserves. RBI has its contingency fund for a very specific reason. And I think it should continue to having that. And Bimal Jalan, in all his wisdom, has recommended 21%, which I think, by the way, if you do any form of international comparison, that's at least about, you know, 10% higher than at least 10% higher than the highest country that we know of, which is, you know, I think Brazil has something like, oh no, sorry, Germany has something like 13%. We are seeing 21%, so that's 8% higher than the highest country that we know of. So, but it's fine. I mean, keep 21% because our set of challenges is very different from what Germany faces. So keep 21%. And even at that level, we can still afford to give, I mean, RBI can still afford to give or transfer 4 lakh crores to the union government. It can do this wisely. It need not all give, for example, to the union government. It can use part of this to give, like, part of, you know, ways and means advances to state governments, etc. And see, because state governments are often, you know, at the forefront of all of this. But, I mean, that I'll leave it to, you know, whatever, the wisdom of the RBI.
Okay. So, this is an additional option, okay, which needs to be explored further and see if this can help us get out of the extraordinary situation that we are in. Right. So, apart from this, the other two recommendations that Devesh Kapoor and Arvind Subramaniam write about is one, reduction in other expenditures. So, for example, the government has a lot of discretionary spending. All governments cut 15% of their discretionary spending and they end all these public sector revival projects, like we have revival of our favorite Mysore sandal soap and KSTL and all that, right? So if such kind of public sector revival projects are actually ended, they say you can make up an additional 1.5 lakh crores. And finally, by raising taxes and cutting subsidies is another, you can raise another 1.5 lakh crores. So if you sum up their menu of options, it comes out to around 11 lakh crores. And what you've added additionally are two things. One is the foreign borrowing route, which should open up after a few months by having a sovereign bonds. And the second option you mentioned is about the using RBI reserves while sticking to Bimal Jalan committee recommendations, right?
My estimate is that I would remove about, because I find some of the things that they've recommended to be slightly optimistic, some of them as pessimistic. So my estimate from, you know, that menu of options, those five options, is probably about 7 to 8 lakh crores. But I'm adding about 8 lakh crores from these two things that I mentioned. But still, all put together, you should have something like 14 to 16 lakh crores. But over the next 3 years or 4 years, remember, it's not all for immediate use, because some of the infrastructure projects will only probably be, you know, kickstarted in next year or late next year, you know, end of 2021. And that's what we're looking at. So, yeah.
Right. That's great, Anupam. Thanks. So I have a better picture of the fiscal space and additional spending needed. Hope our listeners also got a better picture of this. We'll link some of the pieces that we mentioned in the episode. And please remember, as we said, this is all of these options are not the optimal options. All of them are worse off. But we are discussing what are some less worse off options versus some which are even more worse off.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, these are just a menu of options. We don't know which is correct, which is wrong. I mean, there's some things which can work better than the others. But the only thing that would make Pranay and I say that we've got to, you know, the Union government has got to spend 16 lakh crores extra is that these are truly extraordinary times and yes, therefore require extraordinary measures.
Indeed. On that note, we'll end this episode. Thanks, Anupam.
Thank you so much.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.